team bomb!
Change has come to America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
If, or perhaps when, humanity invents an artificial superintelligent computer, will religions try to convert it? And maybe for some listeners, the more important question is, would the AI then become Bapticostal or Presbyterian? Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is a gentleman who's been very busy over the last year. He is a philosopher, futurist, journalist, and author, and perhaps most importantly, a transhumanist. He's the author of the important book, The Transhumanist Wager, which has been described as Atlas Shrugged for the transhumanist movement. He's also now candidate for president on the Transhumanist Party ticket. We'll talk a little bit about that as well over the next half hour or so. It is our pleasure to welcome back to the bunker Zoltan Istvan. Zoltan, it's good to talk with you again.
It's great to talk with you. Thanks so much for having me back.
Well, I appreciate you fitting us into a what must be a busy schedule right now. You're a very prolific writer. You've got articles regularly appearing at the Huffington Post and elsewhere around the web. In particular, the article that prompted this discussion is one that went viral. You published it, or it was published at Gizmodo, and relates to the questions I asked at the opening. Title of the article, When Superintelligent AI Arrives, Will Religions Try to Convert It? And you sent me a private message through Twitter, and I was glad you did, because this is a question that I thought was really intriguing. How do we approach the intersection of artificial intelligence and religious faith? What are your thoughts?
Well, so this is an incredibly complex topic, and it's also very new. So
right.
A lot of the thoughts around it are kind of first time. Last year, I did write an article titled, Are We Heading to a Jesus Singularity? Where I had kind of skimmed the surface and discussed what would happen if all of a sudden artificial intelligence came into being. And just your listeners know, we're talking about kind of a strong artificial intelligence, which essentially means an intelligence that's at equivalent or greater than what the human being is right now. So it's most likely going to be something quite a bit smarter than the human species.
Mm-hmm.
And the basic idea is America, the Congress is 2% Christian at this point. And, that's a very high number. We don't have no atheists basically at the moment, but it's predominantly Christian. And it's safe to say that artificial intelligence will probably be launched in America. It poses such a safety risk that it's worth the nation putting massive amounts of resources in it to make sure that it develops it first and it can control it, rather than, let's say, have Russia develop an entity that could very quickly become much smarter than the human being. But the bottom line is, how does a Christian nation actually feel about an intelligence that's more intelligent than the human species? And more importantly, from a spiritual aspect, what are they going to do with that? Can an artificial intelligence know God? Does it have a soul? These are quintessential questions that I think are going to have to be answered here in the next 10 to 20 years as we actually start getting right at the cusp of launching artificial intelligence. And some experts believe it's going to happen within 20 years. So it poses a very interesting question from a religious point of view. And it's not just Christians, it's all religions.
Sure. In fact, you mentioned the desire, or perhaps the desirability, of the United States developing this before a nation that's perhaps not friendly to us, like Russia or China. There may be a similar competition between various religious denominations or different religions entirely. We can't let the Hindus get this first, because they'll squash every other Christian artificial intelligence that we might develop. Speaking as a Christian, I believe that there will not be a soul in an artificial intelligence because of the book of Genesis. I take that as somewhat historical in so far as God breathing the spirit into his new creation of Adam and Eve. That is where I would come down on it as a matter of faith. But not all Christians feel that way. And for the article in Gizmodo, you interviewed a Presbyterian minister who takes a different view.
Yes, Christopher Benick. And frankly, this article has gone viral. I mean, I've seen this thing in 100 commentary articles have been written about it in at least a dozen languages. And RT, you know, Russia Today, mm-hmm. had also done one. So the entire Hispanic or the entire kind of Latin American world down to South America has republished versions of this as well. So this Christopher Benick has become a very popular man as someone. And I got to say, I know him. He has formed the Christian Transhumanist Association, and he's younger. His views are somewhat radical. He's a nice guy, though. He went to Princeton, got multiple degrees from there in theology, and he's a pastor. And he's, you know, he's when you talk to him, you know that he's just a nice human being. So whether he's right or wrong is really not what's up for, I think, well, at least up for debate for me. But clearly, him and a bunch of other younger people seem to believe that artificial intelligence does possess a soul and therefore should be converted to whatever, you know, denomination they are and whatever kind of, you know, basically should be led to find the love, hypothetically, of Jesus. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is very interesting times because I know a lot of people disagree. In my article, I pointed that out, you know, do robots have souls? And many people feel no, but maybe the younger generation is actually going to feel a bit more comfortable with technology and say, well, if it is that many times smarter than us, because artificial intelligence could potentially become 1,000 times smarter than us within the first few weeks of its life, mm-hmm. What is to say that, you know, that kind of intelligence can't know, you know God, know the power of God?
And that is an interesting topic. There's a science fiction author who I've really come to appreciate. He's also a very outspoken Christian. He blogs regularly under the name Vox Dei, and in a series that he's writing right now with a co-author, not space opera, but it's a future setting in which police officers in this particular planet are enhanced with a neural link to an artificial intelligence. In this particular protagonist's case, he's linked with the uploaded personality of his wife who was killed. And she's a Bible believing Christian. So suddenly you've got the question there of, you know, can this AI, who is his wife, is it really his wife? Is it just a program that is emulating his wife? But, you know, where do you draw that line? And so he's kind of wrestling with that question as well. But this raises a bigger issue of just ethics and morals. And in artificial general intelligence or artificial super intelligence, how do we as humans hope, I mean, forget about evangelizing, how do we program that into a developing super intelligence? And on what standards do we base the morals that we try to program into it?
Well, yeah, and these are the difficult things. So you know, in the Gizmodo article, there were a number of Christian writers, rather well-known ones, that kind of chimed in and said, well, you know, if this machine takes some of the Bible literally, that could be a very serious problem because a lot of the Bible is metaphors and a lot of the Bible is essentially, you know, at least from my point of view, literature where you need to understand that some things happened thousands and thousands of years ago and shouldn't necessarily be applied into any sense today. And I'm not only just speaking as an atheist, as your listeners and you yourself know, but just as, you know, from a practical point of view. So if a machine takes some of the stuff verbatim, that could be very dangerous. So that poses a threat. But at the same time, you know, other people that might say, well, transhumanism and Christianity and artificial intelligence can all go together. They might say, hey, you know, if we teach this machine to know about God, it might be more efficient at teaching it to others, you know, thereby saving more people or converting more people or spreading the word and spreading the gospel better than human beings can do. And so maybe there's a future. And, you know, I mentioned this sort of in my article about robot pastors and robot priests and stuff like this. And it's very much a possibility that in the future, the church could be something that you go to and you there's no single person there. It's a machine telling us things and, you know, doing it more efficiently than could have perhaps been done by a human being.
Yeah, maybe we'll finally solve the conundrum of whether the rapture occurs before the Great Tribulation, midway through or after, which has stumped Christian theologians for the last 2,000 years. this was something that was explored in the reimagined Battlestar Galactica series, where you had the Cylons who knew that they were created beings, knew that they were machines, and yet they had a theology, and it was very much like, at least in the sense of being a monotheistic religion, it was very much like Christianity, insofar, again, as the monotheistic aspect went, whereas the humans were pantheistic and believed in the Greek gods, Roman gods. They used the Roman terms. It was interesting to watch that the exploration of the religion of the Cylons in that particular series. The issue regarding morality, as I see it, regarding an artificial superintelligence, and this is something that recently men like Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking have spoken out about, the danger that this entity, once it becomes self-aware and is so much more intelligent than humanity, may decide that it really has no need of us and finds ways to eliminate what it considers a threat to its own existence. I mean, looking at us and seeing that we might be afraid of it, it might decide to, you know, strike preemptively.
Well, you know, I mean, you're talking about the basically the Terminator scenario,
yep.
Where in Skynet, where ultimately an intelligence smarter than it's, you know, than us, very quickly discovers that we're not only necessary, but we could potentially do some damage to it and try to shut it down. And so, of course, if this artificial intelligence has this desire to remain alive. And I speak quite extensively about that in my novel, The Transhumanist Wager. I've often said that my book is a bridge to artificial intelligence, because I believe that life in itself, what makes life, what makes consciousness kind of something that we can touch and it's tangible to us in a sense that we understand it, is that we have this desire to live. Without a desire to live, we're not even really aware we're alive. So having a desire to live is perhaps the most significant thing we have. And if we imbue an artificial intelligence with this desire to live, and then all of a sudden it becomes, mm-hmm. you know, a few hundred times smarter than us, or even just 10 times smarter than us, we have a problem on our hands. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking and some of these other people are, you know, talking about, because they're not necessarily seeing so many benefits coming from artificial intelligence. Now, we also know it could just completely revolutionize science, and that's why I'm very pro-developing artificial intelligence. But at the same time, I think everyone recognizes that if it's not handled properly, and if it's not handled with some type of safeguards, then the three laws of transhumanism from my book could come to place. And, you know, basically the three laws says that an entity that wants to live is going to try to become as powerful as possible, mm-hmm. thereby becoming this omnipotent being. And it won't stop at being 100 times smarter than us. It won't stop at perhaps being 1,000,000 times smarter. So that leaves us in a very dangerous situation. We might become like ants, or even just, you know, something mm-hmm. even smaller than that. So yes, the morals and the ethics involved with not only how we deal with it, but how it develops those ethics and morals are incredibly important.
What steps are being taken in the transhumanist community now to try to hash out these issues? You know, again, we've got the issue of how do we keep it from wanting to kill us once it becomes self-aware and super intelligent? And then how do we decide which morals and ethics to program into it? You know, forget about the how, but you know, around the world, we've got different religions, different cultures have different standards of morality. There are things that are acceptable here in the United States that are not acceptable in more conservative cultures, Islamic cultures, for example. Who gets to decide what rules we plug into a super intelligent computer?
Sure, you know, and so unfortunately, and not unfortunately, but you know, Gizmodo is a pretty well known publication, mm-hmm. quite I'd say prestigious, and they really only report on facts that are verifiable. My original essay, and I'll probably be writing about this again, talked a lot about why I believe the American government is going to spend all its resources, as many resources as it takes. This is like developing the atomic bomb. No one else can get to this first, because this will change within 24 hours the entire global dynamics of the planet if someone else gets it. gets artificial intelligence first. So I'm pretty sure our military, the United States military, will do whatever it takes to make sure that this happens on its terms. But the reason I mention that is that it's very important to understand, as we started this conversation, that we have a Congress that's largely Christian, and they may try to instill values in this artificial intelligence, which I'm quite certain that they're going to try to be the very first ones to do. And again, once you have one artificial intelligence, you may not have another one ever again. For the same reason that an artificial intelligence may not want humans, it may not want another artificial intelligence, or it might only, you know, want it as some type of subservient entity to it. But the bottom line is, I'm pretty sure that if America was to develop this first, which they probably will, they'll probably put some of their own values and their own ethical systems, and perhaps even some of their religious ideas into it, as a matter of trying to stay the course of what they've done, you know, for the last few hundred years. You know, we can say that there's separation of church and state, but really, when it comes down to it, we're still a very religious infused nation. It's a very Christian infused nation. So I'm pretty sure that some of that will, be put forth towards this development of artificial intelligence. And that raises many different questions, you know, because I think, similar to the atomic bomb, whoever gets this first is going to, you know, for at least the foreseeable future, determine the political outcomes and the power outcomes of all the nations in the world. So it's very important that however you develop this and whoever gets there first, you know, tries to convey their sense of heritage, their sense of ethics, and their sense of moral value. And I'm pretty sure America is going to go the path they've always done, which is, we have this sort of manifest destiny deep down inside our consciousness, and they'll probably somehow program it into it.
American exceptionalism. Yeah. A lot of issues to be hashed out on that particular score. And I'm sure this is a conversation that will continue as we get deeper into the 21st century. There are, you know, researchers like Hugo de Garis, who consider this to be the political issue of the 21st century, and he may well be right. And so, transitioning to politics, last October, you and a group got together, founded the Transhumanist Party, and by a vote of the members of the party, nominated you as the Transhumanist Party candidate for president in 2016. Now, we've seen parties outside the traditional two-headed monster, the Democrat-Republican Party, parties that have dominated American politics for 150 years or thereabouts, really be squeezed by the two dominant parties. It's very difficult for alternate parties like the Libertarians and the Greens and the Constitution Party to even get a seat at the debates, the presidential debates. What is your goal for the Transhumanist Party as we go into this election season?
Well, I think first to just step back a little bit and you know, to understand that the world is actually at a very critical point right now. And I think most Christians will feel this way too. Technology is radically changing our experience. Even now, 20 years ago, had we thought you and I would be doing a podcast so simply, it wasn't that way. I mean, the communications, the science, the medicine, everything is becoming quicker, faster, better, and it's essentially transitioning us into this, what I call the transhumanist age, where we are utilizing the tech as much as possible, and we're planning on doing it a lot more every single year of our lives. So at some point, we'll probably end up being at least somewhat machines or cyborgs, whatever you want to call it. But clearly, we are starting to enter into this transhumanist age. Now, the reason this is important is that the Democrats and the Republicans, sure, they have existed for a long time as the leaders of the two political system as far as humans are concerned. But really, something fundamentally different is happening now. We're coming to a point when, you know, jobs are being lost due to automation and robots and software. And, you know, this is not something that you can solve in the same way you solved the problems of the last 150 years. So this is the reason I created and founded the Transhumanist Party, because I felt we needed a new political organization to address the issues that are coming here in the next 10 and 20 and 30 years, mind uploading, designer babies, ectogenesis or artificial wombs, bionic arms, telepathy via headsets. These are very different forms of technology than we have right now, much more radical. And they're going to need new, I think, ways of governing and new ways of, you know, basically making sure that it doesn't either invade our freedoms or significantly make the world into the a bad place. You know, America has worked a long time to get to the freedoms and the prosperity it has now. So we want to make sure we continue that. And the Transhumanist Party is aiming to lead that kind of discussion. And you're right, there's no chance, I'd say, or less than 1% probably, that the Transhumanist Party is going to make any dent as far as my presidential candidacy, in getting nominated or actually in changing the nature of politics where we become a third party that is now at the forefront and we win elections. But that's not what the Transhumanist Party is about in 2016. What the Transhumanist Party is about in 2016 is to try to lead the conversation. Now, I do believe we can do that. I do believe between my three national columns, I can call out various politicians and get them to answer stuff because, you know, at some point, they must answer the difficult questions. They can't just keep hiding behind taxes and defense and Social Security. They have to answer the question of, hey, when you talk about designer babies, what are going to be allowed and what's not going to be allowed? Mm-hmm. This is technology that's here in 24 months, people doing these things.
Yeah.
So it's not a matter of, you know, waiting forever. So it's going to happen during their tenure and their presidency. So anyways, the Transhumanist Party is trying to make an impression and a dent and spread its knowledge. But more importantly, I am trying to set up the Transhumanist Party for 2020 and 2024 as a legitimate political party that can put people into office. And I'm doing the groundwork right now. It's a lot of work, but I think we can do it. And I think by 2020, 2024, you might find the American public ready for other parties to take over the wheel.
The economy and the politics of the United States is basically driven by, in a nutshell, warfare and welfare, entitlement programs and funding our military adventures overseas. Now, maybe that sounds cynical, but I think when you look at the budget of the U.S. government, I think that's a pretty fair statement. How do you see the technology that, and forgive me, correct me if I mischaracterize this, the technology that you hope will entitle or enable, rather, us to radically extend our lifespans, perhaps even to the extent of immortality? How will that technology change the politics, and how can you guide it? How would you hope to guide it so that it is equitably distributed? And I ask that because, you know, the old joke is that there's a car the car that invented that would run on water, but the oil companies would never allow it to come to market. There are forces out there that would seek to direct this technology for their own financial and political probably ends.
No. And you know, I get asked two questions all the time. The first is, in a transhumanist world where everyone lives forever, how do you deal with the environment? And the second question I get asked, perhaps even more predominantly, is this idea that what's to keep the rich or the elite, the 1%, from running off with this technology and leaving the rest of us either in slavery or just in some dystopian society? And this fits very well into some type of biblical framework as well, where everyone else crashes except for the really rich. Now, when you look at, you know, my answer, and I take a techno-optimistic perspective, of course, my answer is that when you look at some of the leaders of technology and some of the leaders of transhumanism, even if they don't say they're transhumanists, they are leading it. The Mark Zuckerberg, the Elon Musk, the mm-hmm. Bill Gates. These are not people that can do evil. These are people that if they did something wrong to society, if they even showed any aspect of trying to take technology and only keep it from themselves, their companies would sink. These are people who they have built a public image based on being very democratic, very inspiring, and very, absolute supporters of equality and making sure that their technology is not just helping the middle class and the upper class, but helping all classes of people. I have faith in a lot of the new entrepreneurs that have become billionaires, that a lot of the new companies like Google that says do no evil, I have faith that they actually want to spread democracy. And it's democracy that's the key to making sure that we don't have the elite run off with some all this technology and leave the rest of us in the dust. So I am optimistic that, you know, the JP Morgans and the, you know, all the kind of barons of the 20th century, nobody operates like that. You can't in this social media environment. I think the new entrepreneur, the new billionaires are better people and are going to make it so that we can all prosper together and kind of move towards a type of utopian, techno-optimistic future.
Hmm. And I truly hope you're right in that regard. I tend to be a little more cynical, or perhaps it is a biblical worldview where we are told that there is none righteous, no, not one, for man's heart continually turns to evil, and, you know, things like that. What we call sin tends to guide much of what we do. We tend to look after our own self-interest at the expense of all others. In fact, you even allude to that a little bit in that in suggesting that the United States needs to develop the AI first before perhaps potentially unfriendly nations would develop it for themselves. If we do develop it, why would we share it with, say, a nation under the control of a radical Islamist government or a communist government?
Well, I think it would probably end up being just like nuclear weaponry, where we would share it with our allies, and we would always share it in such a limited fashion as no one has too much of it except for us. And, you know, that's nobody likes a superpower. Nobody, you know, wants to say that's what's happening. But that is essentially what is happening, what has happened for many years. And frankly, because the people that make a lot of these decisions for America, the people that vote in their candidates, we have actually held on to a better amount of peace than we might have had for centuries before. Now, artificial intelligence is a whole different entity because, you know, it's one thing to have the biggest bomb. It's another thing to have the smartest intelligence that may not even, you know, our bombs never turned on us, but our intelligence might turn on us. So, you know, like I said, I think what's happening here is we're going to have to develop it first, because to have anyone else develop it is the most dangerous thing. However, it's almost as dangerous to develop it in the first place.
Right.
And this is when when get back to my novel, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point the entire world says, we're not going to develop this whatsoever, and we put very, very strict regulations on some types of transhumanist technologies. And the reason is because it just gets so dangerous. And, you know, that's a real problem that all of us face in the future, is what can we allow and accept, and what can we not allow and not allow for society to sort of move forward and actually still grow and evolve without endangering the species as a whole. These are incredibly difficult questions, and made even more complicated by how fast technology is evolving. Every single year, every single month, something new comes out that I think everyone's like, I can't believe that's happening now.
Hmm. One final question, because I know that you have a limited amount of time this evening. And this goes back to an article that you wrote in August of last year. Let me premise this by saying, is it fair to characterize transhumanism as, in a nutshell, as self-directed evolution?
Yes, that's a great way to say it.
Okay. You wrote an article that was published in the Wired over in the UK last August with the title, It's Time to Consider Restricting Human Breeding. If you begin with the premise that much of the world's suffering in terms of overpopulation, starvation, poor health, limited access to necessary resources like clean water, shelter, and so forth is due to overpopulation. If you begin with that premise, it sounds like a reasonable proposition. The question I would ask you then is, as a candidate for president, how far do you take this proposal? Would this be something that would be part of a transhumanist party platform going forward? And the follow-up question, of course, would be, who decides who gets to have children?
Yeah, so this is such a thorny question. So let me just first say that it's not part of the transhumanist party platform, nor is it part of my candidacy for president. it's simply too challenging to even consider to take away those kind of freedoms from people. However, just because it's not part of the platform or not something that I'm advocating for doesn't mean that we have a very serious problem. You know, the reason I wrote that article is that we have around 10,000 children that starve to death every single day. Mm. And this not only hurts my heart, but it just hurts my sense of what is it that we're doing on planet Earth that we can't do. You know, we can send people to the moon, we can fly in jet airplanes all across the world, you know, we can develop telepathy and do all these incredible technologies, and yet we can't feed 10,000 kids a day and let them starve to death. I mean, it ends up being something like 70, 80 million kids over 20, 30 years. It's incredible. I mean, this is, you know, these are incredibly, absolutely tragic numbers. So what can we do to stop that? And, you know, I had put forth that proposal as a philosopher, as someone who's trying to put, you know, create ideas and get the public talking about these things. And it was another article that went very viral.
Yeah.
And it certainly, you know, got a lot of people thinking. And, you know, I'm not the only one to advocate for some of those things from a philosophical position. However, when you talk about the public, when you talk about my presidential candidacy, it's impossible to talk in terms of that because I don't want to upset that many people. However, you can rest assured that should I ever be elected into office or, you know, when I get asked these questions, I'm going to say we will find an answer because whatever the answer is, it's unacceptable. It's absolutely unacceptable to let 10,000 kids starve to death around the planet every day. Mm. That is something that must be tackled no matter how we do it. Now, my idea, of course, from the article is controlling birth and stuff like that is pretty aggressive. But there are other methods we can do, and we should absolutely explore them.
Yeah. And as a Christian, you know, when I was a kid in church and I heard the Bible verse where Jesus said, "The poor you will always have with you," I thought that was just a really negative outlook until I became old enough to realize that he wasn't talking about a problem of distribution. He was talking about a problem of the heart, the problem of sin. We've got grain from 2013 that's still sitting in bins in North Dakota because there's not enough money to make it profitable for the farmers to move. The problem is that oftentimes aid goes to a nation where it's needed, and it's commandeered by the guy with the most guns. And until that problem is solved, we may not have an answer to this. But I appreciate that you're looking for an answer in the spirit of trying to prevent and eliminate that kind of suffering. And on that, we can certainly agree. I think it's in that spirit that we can find it, you know, at least a dialogue to try to understand where we're both coming from and coexist. And I'll say again, with tongue kind of in cheek, the conversations that we've had, and we've only talked twice, but we've had more pleasant conversations, and I think productive conversations than I will sometimes have with people when we start discussing the nature of you know, end times prophecy. Somebody throws out a theory, someone else disagrees, and it sadly can sometimes turn pretty ugly. Zoltan, where do people follow your work and your writings so they can keep up with your thoughts and what the Transhumanist Party and transhumanist thought from a philosopher's perspective is how it's developing?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, to begin with, if your listeners are interested, just go to transhumanistparty.org, and that's the official website of the Transhumanist Party, and we have news updates and stuff like that. And then, of course, I write three national columns, the Transhumanist Philosopher and Psychology Today, one for Huffington Post, and also my newest one, which is called Transhumanist Future for Vice's Motherboard. Mm. And of course, if anyone's also interested, they're welcome to read my novel, The Transhumanist Wager. It was a bestseller in philosophy on Amazon, number one. However, from a political point of view, I'm also sort of like the Wired article, distancing myself a little bit from that novel, as it is pretty aggressive and a little bit authoritarian. However, you know, it's still a pretty interesting novel, fictional story about transhumanism, and certainly covers all aspects of it. And I do encourage people to read it if they just want to get a really interesting science fiction philosophical story. And lastly, if you want to just visit anything about me, I'm at ZoltanIstvan.com. And, you know, check out some of my other articles I haven't posted on my website.
And I would vouch for the Transhumanist Wager being an interesting and informative read. And again, I think important considering the importance of the topic of transhumanism as we get into the 21st century. Zoltan István, best wishes to you, and I hope we can talk again at some point down the road.
Absolutely, Dirk. It's been such a great time to talk to you again. I always love talking to you, so thank you.
Of course, if you turn to the show notes at vftb.net, you'll find links to the website Zoltan just referred to, and I encourage you to read his work and follow his thoughts at his blog and in his daily columns, because he's done an excellent job using social media and his skill as a writer, which is substantial, to get the message of the transhumanist movement into, or closer to, the mainstream anyway. This is something we are going to have to contend with as believers in the 21st century. This is why I've been giving presentations about this, obviously from a different perspective than Zoltan. I like him. You can hear the two conversations we've had. We get along well. And I think it's because I understand that he is trying to address what he sees as suffering, needless suffering in this world. And absent the existence, in his worldview, of a transcendent God, the technology promised by the transhumanist movement is, in his mind, the best course of action to eliminate that suffering. And of course, transhumanists would also see, absent the existence of a transcendent God, that technology is their only hope of eternal life. Now, as a Christian, and as a Christian because I believe the historical evidence of the New Testament was accurately preserved and is compelling, I believe that I am already looking forward to a post-human future. I am in the process of becoming a trans-human and will eventually be a post-human. And as the old song goes, you know, what a glorious day that will be. That is a fundamental difference. But at least I understand, I think, that his motives are not evil. And what he's trying to do is solve problems that have plagued humanity for all of recorded history. Starvation, suffering, sickness, and of course, the big one, death. The problems that I have with transhumanism, in a nutshell, is that, like the old saying goes, another old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. The reason I asked Zoltan the question about self-directed evolution is because that is a phrase that was also adopted by the eugenics movement of the early 20th century. And eugenics back in the, from 1900 till about 1935 or thereabouts, was considered the pinnacle of science. That through the science of selective human breeding, we could increase the strength, the health, the vitality of the human race, and thus ensure our long-term survival. There was also a patriotic element in it. That there were county fairs in the 1920s and 1930s that would display ideal families so that people attending the fair could see what an ideal American family should look like. These are the kind of people we should breed, that we should encourage to breed. And again, that's why I asked him about his column from last fall last summer in Wired magazine about considering restricting human breeding. When you look at the problem and you see that there are starving children in Africa, and assume that the problem, or conclude that the problem, I should say, is due to an overabundance of children and a scarcity of food, or a scarcity of food because of an abundance of children, then restricting the number of people who can have children seems like a logical answer. It's a difficult choice, but it seems like a logical answer. I think that one of the fundamental differences, other than the presumption or the presupposition that we make, different presuppositions about the existence of God, is faith in government to do the right thing. I think the one thing we've learned, or should have learned, from 6,000 years of recorded history is that mankind, in the words of Sigmund Freud, man is a wolf to man. We prey on one another, the strong preying upon the weak. I would suggest that the reason there are so many starving people is because there are so many people in power who exercise that power by withholding critical goods, services, basics of existence from others in order to keep them under control. Or as Jesus put it, the poor you will always have with you. Why? Not because we can't figure out how to get grain to market, but because there are people who will intercept that grain and keep it from getting to those in need. People who will intercept water or control water supplies to keep it from getting those to keep it from getting to those who need it. Those who will intercept foreign aid and control it for their own gain. How do we prevent that? How do we eliminate that? We haven't figured out how to do that yet in human society. And absent that, and if we start building supermen on top of that, granting omnipotence to people who are already inclined to exert authority over others to the point of starving them to death, denying critical medical supplies and access. Why in the world would we want to grant them omnipotence and superintelligence? That's another issue that I think needs to be addressed. Now, if there are people who believe that their future lies in uploading their minds into a robotic head, which was a proof of concept recently introduced, actually not recently, it's about 5 years ago now, the founder of the TerraSim Institute, which is as close to a transhumanist religion as you will find, Martin Rothblatt introduced this concept, robotic head based on her wife's head. Martin is the former Martin Rothblatt, to show that it might be possible someday to upload someone's personality, their mind, into a computer and connect it to a physical avatar, in this case, a robotic head. If somebody wants to do that, that's fine. The reason I speak out about this, and I know that Tom Horn feels the same way, Sharon feels the same way, is because when you go down that path, you really are crossing the line from technology into religion. I suspect most transhumanists would deny that, but it's true. It's true. Religion seeks to address the big questions. Where did we come from? Our creation story. Why are we here? Where do we go when we die? And if the answer to that question is you were uploaded into a cosmic mainframe to power an avatar, well, that's a religious promise. That is a metaphysical concept that you're dealing with. And we as Christians, who by definition believe in the supernatural realm, should be prepared to at least address this question. And I don't think we can address it by saying they'll never develop the technology. It's not feasible. It'll never happen. I think those that are inclined to put their faith in science, in technology, will automatically switch off and assume that we're Luddites, afraid of technology. You know, I am anything but afraid of technology. I've said before, just from where I sit in line of sight, I've got more internet-connected devices than I can count. I just don't want one put in my head. I don't want to become part of a planetary meta-intelligence, which is the dream, the goal, the end of human evolution, according to Dr. Peter Diamandis, who partnered with Dr. Raymond Kurzweil in the founding of Singularity University. Dr. Diamandis, a brilliant man, has 2 degrees from MIT, one in aerospace engineering and one in molecular biology, I believe. And then he also has a medical degree from Harvard Medical. A brilliant man. But he believes that ultimately humanity will be interconnected. Our minds will be connected into a giant hive mind, whether through implants in our cortical implants or through optogenetics, and will become a giant hive mind, a planetary meta-intelligence. That, the end result of humanity. Now, that is a very Eastern concept, very Buddhist, the loss of self into the cosmos, the complete dissolution of self. Nirvana, that's the exact opposite of Christianity, in which self is preserved and glorified, restored to a near-perfect state or a glorified state anyway, at the resurrection. And interestingly enough, in such a state, according to the Apostle Paul, we will judge angels. Pretty cool when you think about it. Might be why the fallen angels are so upset at us. But anyway, fundamentally, diametrically opposed worldviews, diametrically opposed answers to the question, where do we go when we die? Not a cosmic mainframe. And again, getting back to the point about faith in government, this type of interconnectedness, this merger of technology and biology. Since the summer of 2013, we've been hearing over and over again about the back doors built into technology by the National Security Agency, by other foreign governments, but especially the NSA. Do you really want something inside your head that might have a back door granting access to a spook? A government spy sitting in an office somewhere? I think that's a bad idea. These are questions that need to be addressed because the technology is coming at us at breakneck pace. According to Dr. Raymond Kurzweil, we will experience an estimated 20,000 years worth of progress over the next century. That's 1,000 times more progress than we saw from 1900 until today, roughly the last 100 years. Considering that transportation, personal transportation, went from horse and buggy to the internal combustion front-wheel drive, 2015 model, whatever, that we are now putting probes into outer space, probes that have passed the limit of our solar system, that our ability to communicate has gone from literally walking across town to hand-deliver messages or to see somebody face-to-face to speak with them, to being able to Skype with somebody on the other side of the planet in real time. That's the kind of change we've seen over the last 100 years or so, and we're going to see 1,000 times more change over the next century. We need to be prepared to deal with the concept of spiritual machines as Christians. But I think we need to do it remembering that those who are seeking to create spiritual machines aren't bad people. They aren't evil people. They sincerely believe they're trying to solve a problem, many of them. And we as Christians need to address the issues on those terms. Find common ground and go from there. Because if we come at them with a Bible in one hand and Bible in both hands ready to bash them over the head, we're not going to get anywhere. There will be no progress. We will make no progress in discussing this issue. So expect to hear more programs on this topic going forward. And on Skywatch TV, we will be devoting a lot of time to this. Again, especially as we prepare to release the Tom Horn documentary, Inhuman, which will, be featured at least excerpts on Skywatch TV. That should be out in 2015. I know that's in final editing now. Speaking of Skywatch TV, as Sharon and I prepare to make the transition from Illinois to Missouri, the movers are coming less than 1 week to pack us up and move us. There may be a week or two with no PID radio and no view from the bunker as we make that transition. But just a quick plug for Skywatch TV as we look to get that launched and onto cable and satellite channels around the globe. DirecTV, other networks out there are being pitched. We are looking for your assistance, and Tom is offering a very attractive giveaway for any donation. Now, Skywatch TV is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so your donation is tax deductible. But for any size donation, you get the books Redeemed Unredeemable by Tom Horn and Donna Howell, Blood on the Altar by multiple authors, including Sharon and myself, Labyrinth by Mark Flynn, rather the Of course, I can't read the whole thing here. Anyway, Mark Flynn's latest book, Labyrinth. Mark Flynn, of course, the twin brother of David Flynn, who we've talked about many times on the program here. And, of course, Chris Putnam's excellent book, The Supernatural Worldview. All four of those yours for making a tax-deductible donation of any amount to Skywatch TV. And you'll find information there at skywatchtv.com. Coming up this Sunday, Doug Stauffer returns. More questions about the pre-tribulation rapture. We will dig back into Matthew 24, and we'll look at 1 Thessalonians 5, and if there is time, we will try to address some additional questions about the pre-tribulation rapture. And don't worry, other perspectives, other views will get their turn as well as we continue to try to make sense, to deepen our understanding of the timeline of what is ahead of us. We appreciate your reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you find A View from the Bunker. You'll find links to subscribe to A View from the Bunker via your favorite podcatcher, whether it's iTunes or Stitcher or some other device. Just look in the right-hand column at vftb.net. And, of course, we appreciate it if you stop by our page at Facebook and click the like button there. Got to keep up with those guys from Canary Cry Radio. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. Until next time, I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.